Penguin Random House Audio presents The Small and the Mighty, 12 unsung Americans who changed the course of history from the founding to the civil rights movement. This is the author, Sharon McMahon. For Chris, who has always believed that anything is possible and that I am capable of achieving it. Introduction. New York, 1804. Alexander Hamilton was going to die, and he knew it. He was stoic, though his pain was great. His brow was feverish, his body now partially paralyzed from the bullet lodged in his spine. Dose after dose of wine and laudanum were poured down his throat to take the edge off. The tang of coagulating blood hung so heavy in the July air that the people tending to his injuries could nearly taste it on their tongues. As his wounds oozed, his body grew ever more gray and still. It was late morning, and while the sun was high in the sky, the shadowy specters of a man meeting his untimely end collected in the corners of the room. Perhaps sensing his time was near, Hamilton asked for the minister of the church to which his family belonged to bring him communion. But Reverend Bishop Moore refused. He didn't approve of dueling, and he didn't believe Hamilton to be a good enough Christian to deserve the Episcopal rites. It was Hamilton's wife, Eliza, who warmed the pew that Alexander paid for. But A.Ham, as he signed his letters, was rarely seen in Trinity Church. "Please," Alex might have whispered, "call Reverend John Mason." Mason was a friend who pastored a Presbyterian church. Mason, too, refused, saying it gave him no pleasure, but he could not privately give communion to anyone. Hamilton became desperate in his last hour to receive the sacrament of the Last Supper. He turned back to Bishop Moore, his eyes pleading for help. "Dueling is barbaric," Moore told him, "and the church can't condone it." With the strength he had left, Hamilton assured Bishop Moore that he regretted his actions and offered his forgiveness to Aaron Burr for shooting him. If he lived, he promised to spend his days demonstrating just how sorry he was. Moore relented, and Hamilton, with great difficulty, swallowed the sip of wine and the morsel of bread. The Hamiltons' 7 living children assembled around him as his blood slowly soaked into the floor of his friend's home, a stain that would remain there in memoriam for years. Hamilton opened his eyes, drank in the tear-stained faces of the children he delighted in, and slowly closed them again, his lids now feeling quite heavy. For the last time, he kissed the sweaty forehead of his toddler son, Philip, named after the son who had himself died in a duel just a few years earlier. Eliza felt grief's icy fingers tighten its grip around her chest. Her breath grew rapid, shallow, each unconscious contraction of her diaphragm pushing air painfully through her lungs. "It can't end like this," she might have thought. "These babies need you. Please, God. No. No." Eliza didn't know it yet, but Alex had already penned her a goodbye letter, just in case things ended poorly during his duel with the Vice President of the United States. It read, "This letter, my very dear Eliza, will not be delivered to you unless I shall first have terminated my earthly career. The consolations of religion, my beloved, can alone support you. Fly to the bosom of your God and be comforted. With my last idea, I shall cherish the sweet hope of meeting you in a better world. Adieu, best of wives and best of women. Embrace all my darling children for me. Ever yours, A.H." You, my friend, may have heard a version of this story before. But there's one character in this scene who you may not have met. A man who, if we shift our focus just slightly to the edge of Hamilton's deathbed, opens a portal to a new and fascinating drama.